Welcome to Regenerative Rising's podcast, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm your host, Celine Diaris, and with me today is Zach Ducheneau, who is the administrator of the Farm Service Agency with the USDA. He's formerly the executive director of Intertribal Agriculture Council, which serves 80,000 producers in Indian Country. Welcome to our podcast, and I'm so honored to have an opportunity to have this conversation with you. Obviously, agriculture is an important part of the American landscape, and how we are attending to the variety of challenges facing our world, many of which have an intersection with agriculture. One thing I wanted to begin with, Zach, is to talk a little bit about, I think, a statistic that people may not know, which is that off-farm income, like income and wages and salaries from off-farm jobs, makes up 72% of total income. I think that most of us would not anticipate that staggering a figure, and that 82% of farms rely on this outside income.
Yeah.
I mistakenly say it, 96% of farm households derive income from outside, and it's 72% that are actually jobs, wages. And then another percentage are coming from pensions and investment income, but the majority is actually other wages.
And one of the statistics that the secretary has been quoted several times in the last few months that really resonates with that same message is that 89% of our farmers and ranchers make more than half of their income off the farm. And I think that's fundamentally something that we've got to look to change. I don't know of any bankers or corporate food executives that have to have another income stream just to be able to do their critical part for feeding and clothing our society. So we're definitely keen to that statistical set and wanting to find ways to help solve that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's like, there are obviously people who are earning from multiple jobs, but when you are operating a large operation, whatever it might be, that's your job. And that's what pays your salary and provides for your family. So for this situation to exist in our agricultural community and in rural communities in particular, it's concerning.
It is very concerning. And I think a critical point to draw out of this conversation is that lack of income from our production doesn't have to be. When you think about the price of food in this country, there is so much that's being gobbled up by the middlemen. And if it was strictly the cost of production that consumers were realizing when they spent their food dollar, that would be one thing altogether different. But there's this, especially in the beef industry, as the president and the secretary highlighted last week, such a large portion of that is profit for that multinational corporation. And it's coming not only at the expense of the producers, but also at the expense of the consumers. And we've got to take steps to deploy the government resources to help put producers on at least a level playing field in that regard.
Well, I would also say it's harming animals as well. The circumstances of slaughter facilities are notoriously problematic. And so much of what once was held within community operation activity has changed into this monolith of activity. And I think that's part of the problem, as you're stating, because that's that middleman operation that's charging for slaughter and then charging for the final sale. And so your producer has a very limited stream of income in that entire pathway. So I'm also thinking about the fact that we don't grow a whole lot of food in the United States. We grow commodity crops. And a lot of those crops are actually fed to those animals. And a lot of those crops are inappropriate food for those animals. So it's the agricultural system has been a cash crop orientation in this society since the inception of this country.
I don't think I disagree with anything you said there, Selene, but I might want to pose it another way. I mean, the system has our producers confined to their existing ways of production.
Correct. And,
you know, you talk about confinement operations within the ag industry. Our farms and ranches function as confinement operations. Our producers don't have the economic liberty to make a different choice in their production practices because they're on this commodity cycle tempo where a producer might want to desperately transition to an organic, regenerative soil health approach on their farm or ranch. The capital isn't available that allows them that 2 to 3 year transition without an income. So all of the capacity that our producers might have for innovating and leading us in this fight for climate change mitigation strategies and climate smart agriculture is expended just surviving in the system. We've got to change it. And that starts with getting the producer a greater share of the existing food dollar so that they can change what they do with existing production income, irrespective of what type of production it is, so that they've got some chances and freedom to make different choices with that production income.
I appreciate that you're saying that, and especially given your role, because the USDA has been, with all due respect, a part of the problem for a very long time. There's a reward system within that whole process that has kept a certain way of agriculture maintained. And I think to your point, this opportunity to innovate, this opportunity to reward producers for land conservation initiatives, for most importantly, improving soil health and becoming, you know, moving away from the monocropping system towards systems that actually are more innovative, more diverse, and would create additional income streams for farmers if they could have some support around that initiative and also the risk.
Absolutely. And we've made a huge move towards more thoughtful deployment of some of our conservation-based programs. CRP, for example, we've increased the incentive payments for producers to enroll their land in those conservation practices. But I think maybe too often we get focused on the conservation aspect of our CRP program and not the reserve aspect. We're reserving and enhancing the productivity of that soil for future generations to be able to capitalize and carry on. But I really want to drive the point home that the big ag industry, as it is exemplified by the meatpacking industry, in the protein sector, is designed to keep a shroud between the consumer and the producer.
Right.
And instead of seeing clearly each other and understanding the nature of each other's reality, we're fighting around that shroud. And I think it's a misconception that every ag producer that's out there doing this wouldn't do better if they could afford to. Wouldn't do better for the environment, wouldn't do better for the soil. And too often we get pit against our consumers. You know, I know any number of the cattle growers that live just across our fence line would rather do organic grass-fed beef, but there is no mechanism to convey that to the consumer. So we've got to work on building those connections with the consumers and realize that we're in this together, and corporations don't really have a tangible presence in the environment, so they don't have a vested interest. They're about balance sheets and shareholder returns. We've got to find a way to get ourselves aligned as producers with our consumers and start to take some ownership of the process again.
I like hearing that because as you know, my focus and my work has been around the regenerative agriculture conversation. And we've been bringing industry leaders from both the food and the fashion industries together to really look at how can you innovate in your supply? How can you create investment and incentives to producers? And many companies are starting to look at how do they aggregate supply in a way that does really support and benefit the producer, the grower, so that that element that we're talking about in the beginning about this disparity and where income is coming from and that pressure is significant. So how to change the law? I mean, this is a big conversation, really. I mean, we're talking about how do we disrupt patterns that have existed literally for hundreds of years. And they have a lot of vested interests in them. And yet at the same time, we are inside of huge crises, both on a social level and on an ecological level. And there really is no separation between the two. The social and the ecological are of one fabric. And the opportunity for us to address those interrelated challenges are, in essence, have a very similar solution.
Yeah, I agree. And another misconception is that there's not room for profitability and affordability in this spectrum. And one of the data points that I've been fond of using in my past career is that food dollar data point. It's been in the last 10 years, it's been anywhere from 8 cents to 11. One year it was 14 cents of every food dollar actually makes it back to the grower. And that's a disparity that we've got to upend and try to shift that paradigm.
Well, and it also makes sense to me because, there are some ranchers out there that now go direct to consumers, but that is another level of enterprise activity and investment and effort, and not everyone can do that. So it shouldn't be a constraint, to your point, that the reward back to the producer isn't a higher percentage of the overall food dollar. And that seems like a moral issue as well. Like that just isn't correct for that to be the status.
And I think it's a food safety issue in that regard. And there's another aspect of this that is a national security issue. We can come back to that maybe, but from the food safety perspective, I mean, if you read the trade publications around food, you see the recalls, you see the products having to get pulled back off the store shelves. People are having to destroy them because of foodborne pathogens. Or challenges.
Yes.
And you don't see that from Harriet Meat Market in Harriet, South Dakota. And when you bring all of these vectors together and you process them together in the aggregate, you create opportunity for these pathogens to spread. It might have been one head of lettuce that had the E. coli on it, and that tainted the whole run for the day. You don't see that type of thing in the local and small processing facilities as prevalent. So there's definitely a food safety aspect as well, to say nothing of the nutrition component of products grown in healthy soil and the bioavailability of nutrients.
I mean, that is, in my estimation, should probably be at the top of all of our lists. The lack of high nutrient dense foods is real. It's been going on for a long time. It's been known as we've depleted soil health over the years. And I think we're hitting kind of a critical point. And it's a beautiful opportunity, given the fact that if we do invest the effort to improve soil health, we'll be improving the nutrient structure for plants and then for those who consume the plants, but also will be pulling legacy carbon out of the atmosphere and attending to this deep imbalance in like how much carbon is in the atmosphere, and carbon cycles are disrupted. We have weird patterns with rain. We have all sorts of issues that are tied to this broken cycle. And what I find so inspiring around all of this is that the solution is literally beneath our feet. And it isn't that huge a stretch to say we could address it.
I 100% agree. And it seems like there's this overarching notion that if we just keep adding to what we're doing, no matter how bad it fits what we want to have happen, we'll eventually get to what we want to have happen. And sometimes you do need to step back away from what you're doing and say, man, this seems to be a never-ending cycle. How do I change that? And often what that comes back down to for the family-sized farmer, you don't have the patient capital you need to do that. So I use the beef cattle industry, the cow-calf guy, as an example a lot. Most of the producers that I've had occasion to work with in the last 20 years have to sell nearly all of their production every year in order to just make ends meet and maintain a static existence. We need to move towards a reality where finance is structured to allow for production income to accumulate on the balance sheet in a working capital reserve. Because once you have a producer that has all of the operating capital they need at this time of the year without having to borrow it, they can really make thoughtful choices about what they're going to do with that production opportunity that's in front of them for the next growing season.
I completely agree with you. And in fact, I was listening to a previous podcast we did with Wizapan Little Elk, and he was talking about what they're doing at Rosebud is they're having 1,500 head of buffalo, and they only plan to harvest 300 to 400 animals a year. And he was talking about how, and I know this is not any different in cow communities either, cattle. There is a community in that animal space that has its own expression. It's a matriarchal society. And it actually benefits from a more natural existence where you have elders who remain unculled in that group. And I think something we don't think about is this other dimension of mutuality and respect for these animals, that we shouldn't just be raising them to slaughter them. We should be investing in this longer term view for this larger well-being of a herd rather than this all or nothing proposition, which to me also doesn't really honor the life of these animals and their own experience and journey, which I think we should value.
Yeah, I agree. And Wheezy's a good friend of mine, and now he's working over in the Department of Interior, helping us advance the cause for the administration. So I really look forward to some collaboration with him around those. And the harvest approach that he's talking about is something that every cattle rancher would love to be able to do. And that, our place and other folks that are really have circumstances that allow them to take a different approach. And ours is there are 5 to 6 people at any given moment on this ranch that have off-farm income. So that allows us to have the capital resources to make some different choices. And we're actually contemplating that herd dynamic. The heifer calves, all of our calves right now are out there learning how to live in winter with the cows.
Right.
And there isn't a cattleman alive that I know of that relishes the idea of gathering up all of his calves at 5 months of age jamming them in a truck, taking them to a livestock auction where they're exposed to thousands of other animals, and go to a feedlot. If our producers had the capability, they would be managing a more blended herd, I believe, where they're growing grass-fed carcasses to go from their place after they've lived a thoughtful life into a processing center where they can go to nourish and help the economy of the country.
You know, for those who don't like the idea of animals as food, I also have to remind all of us is that animals play and always have played an extremely natural role in our ecosystems. And part of the sad outcome of CAFOs and that confined animal environment is that all of that nutrients of those animals is no longer integrated into a grassland environment or onto a farm site where you have them being moved through like a polyculture, being moved through a farm landscape so that you've got that contribution of their excrement nourishing the soil, feeding the soil biome. I mean, there are so many missed opportunities for a new way of leaning into all of this resource that we have. Yet we're not allocating that resource in a way that actually builds a long-term state of health for the land and for the people.
And without that animal impact on that soil, as you stated, soil health will degrade. It will not, you know, it doesn't advance once you take the grazing animals out of the equation. And folks in that regenerative grazing movement are really starting to take a look at their livestock as the tool they use to develop their soil. And I think when you take that approach and that you're able to more thoughtfully use that tool in a way that aligns with its existence, I think there's a chance for us to make some headway in that regard too. And again, the industry puts us at odds with each other instead of thinking about how do we include those folks that maybe don't have the capacity to engage in this production practice in what we're doing. We end up bickering with each other instead of talking about the solutions. And the simple fact of the matter is, there will never be enough wildlife on this continent to mimic what we can do with domesticated livestock. And I count buffalo as domesticated livestock. I don't buy into the notion that they're a wild animal. And I think that confounds the issue around animal husbandry that our people worked for millennia before the Europeans got here to cultivate.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think it's so important to recognize this there's like a multiverse of possibility here. And it's always curious to me when I talk to other colleagues who are in the industry, there are so many farmers and ranchers who are really interested in a new process, a new way forward. And I think the thing that we probably will talk about next is one of the huge obstacles is money and how money is distributed in the system. A loan is very different from an investment. And patient capital, you mentioned before, I think that is probably one of the biggest opportunities in how we look at what our future is in terms of this integrated approach of addressing climate, addressing nutrition, addressing farmer well-being and income. It kind of all wraps around this issue of money and how money gets into the hands of the producers and how that money has to be returned.
If you look at the way capital is currently deployed towards ag production, it's really akin to having a patch of soil and planting a perennial seed, and then going out every year, harvesting that perennial seed, and then turning around and replanting it to perennial again without realizing the benefit of the deployment of that perennial crop. The harvest of capital out of this system isn't sustainable. That's why we've got ever increasing farm debt ever since 1994. It's been a 4% average annual increase in farm debt. Mm. And as a result of that, farmer and rancher stress continue to stay at very high levels. And it's always because of finances. It's always because of how am I going to be able to communicate what's going on here with my banker? Am I going to be able to feed my family from my production income? And the answer is invariably no. And finance doesn't do enough to structure it for those producers to be able to do that. Now, you mentioned loan versus investment, and that's something that I really want to drive home while I have the chance to here within the agency. We shouldn't act like a bank, but we do. We should act like a venue for providing federal assistance to producers. And we're stuck in this paradigm of where we function too much like a commercial lending entity. And I think that we should reimagine the way we're doing this and start to think about the investments that we've made as a nation in infrastructure like the highway system, like rural electric, like we're doing with broadband, and make those type of term investments in agriculture. And we should be thinking about the return on our investment, which can be both monetary and in broader ranging secondary and tertiary benefits.
Absolutely. You know, another thing that I really loved about something Wizapan was talking about is, you know, wealth has a multiple of meanings. You can have the return on investment on ecological enhancement and services of sequestering carbon. You can have the return on investment of higher nutrient dense food, which contributes to the health of your population, which reduces the cost of unhealth. And obviously this country has some serious health issues. Many are tied to the food system and empty calories that people consume that go nothing towards giving their bodies the foundation it requires for good health.
And as we contemplate those additional, maybe one-off benefits, I think it's important to come back to the actual financial conversation here, because too often we get bound up in the cost of it. And something that's not very widely known that I'm trying to elevate is that within our farm loan programs at the Department of Agriculture in the Farm Service Agency, there are certain aspects of those farm loan programs that actually have a negative cost to the taxpayer.
I'm sure.
They actually provide a positive return to the government. And that's our real estate portfolio, our farm ownership loans, and our guaranteed farm ownership loans do not cost the taxpayer. They provide a benefit to the taxpayer. And I'm a student of history and trying to understand where we're at now so that we can build that future. And in looking at our historic portfolio, I don't think that the correlation there between that aspect of our loan programs that doesn't have an effective cost to the taxpayer versus the other aspects of our loan programs that do, that's our farm, what's known as our farm operating loans. That's your annual operating and your production asset expenses. Those have a cost to the taxpayer in the form of loss when things go wrong and there's defaults.
Right.
But I don't think the correlation is necessarily the fact that on the one hand, we're taking real estate as a security asset and selling it at a profit to realize the negative cost. I think it's the structure of the capital deployment that's beneficial. And we may need to take that same approach to what we're doing on the production asset side and structure that more like a long-term investment.
That, right.
That allows that capital to circulate.
Yeah, because real estate is usually a long-term and a lower interest rate for a longer period of time. So if, again, kind of going back to that idea of patient capital, if that money were being integrated into the equation in a, you know, there's a lot of opportunity around who receives money and how that money has to be paid back and the time period for that payback, which just as sort of a segue to this, I'd like to touch on the work for disenfranchised members of society, the socially disadvantaged programs that I think you all also manage to Black, Native American, Hispanic, and women are just as a group listed there and who qualifies as socially disadvantaged. How is that program have any intelligence to it that could go to these other systems, or is it also stuck in the same cycle of a shorter term capital system as well?
Well, those groups are even more susceptible to being confined into this captive system, because part of being socially disadvantaged or historically underserved or disenfranchised is you haven't had the benefit of program participation to help supplement production income in a way that you're able to amass wealth or assets to weather any storms that come up.
Right,
so
right.
Those folks are more confined within this captive system. There are some people moving different ways of doing things to try to address that and really taking that longer term investment style approach. But as we talk about finance, it's really important to draw out that the example that I believe is demonstrated by our various farm loan programs, where one has a negative cost, one has a positive cost. It's very rarely the interest rate or the return that is the problem. It is the artificial extraction of the initial invested capital that puts the producers in a bind. If you go to any commercial lender, they're going to want you to have a five-year loan for a beef cow. That does not leave enough capital in that system for that cow to produce enough to cover her expense, the cost of the capital, and replace herself. So that producer with that five-year loan is stuck on that perpetual cycle, confined forever to outside income.
So what would be the innovation to change that? What would be a better strategy?
So you take a more holistic approach to what that producer's plan is, and you structure your financing to that. I had the opportunity in my previous work to be part of creating a community development financial institution. And we had some success in securing some funds to pilot a new approach. And in that approach, we were able to offer a interest-only finance instrument to producers for the first 5 years of their existence. It allows them to get their feet under them, build some assets, fine-tune their production to what their available resources are, and then start to make a plan on how to pay back that investment.
I see.
And when you take this approach, that CDFI, for instance, is getting a 10% return on its investment in those first 5 years. But because the capital is staying deployed to grow on the producer's balance sheet, that's more affordable for a producer than even the Farm Service Agency's low interest loans.
Wow. How receptive is the federal system to these types of innovative ideas?
I think the federal system is receptive to that and looking for examples of how we can do things a little different. There are other interests that are at play that may feel that's cutting into their domain a little bit. You know, commercial lending probably isn't going to like the notion that we're thinking about this, and they don't necessarily want the competition for those producers. But they have the benefit of being able to be with their producers for a longer horizon, a longer time horizon, and reap the security of more mature producers from an economic standpoint, producers that have been able to amass some wealth and some asset base and have a more favorable debt to asset ratio, stay on the bank's balance sheets. And our current style of doing business is we try to push those producers out of our system, and that confines us to this static risk pool where we're taking on those that banks won't serve, helping them reach some level of economic maturity, and then pushing them out the door instead of keeping them along to balance that risk across our portfolio. So there is interest in this administration, for sure at the agency level, in examining other ways and trying to find a way to afford to make these changes and broaden the scope of the work that we do. You know, that's an ongoing conversation that I have with our team there at the Farm Service Agency almost daily.
Are there private public partnerships with different groups that are sort of emergent on the horizon in the more focused on regenerative agriculture and carbon sequestration, who have developed investment portfolios? Is that ever a sit down at the table and work together?
Not as of yet that I've seen in terms that I think are going to be beneficial and really move the needle on this. So the reason that we, in creating that CDFI and that method of investment, arrived at a 10% initial rate of return was so that we could develop something that's marketable to private foundations, philanthropies, as a actual investment. Too often our innovators are relegated to conversations with the program delivery side of these institutions, and not often enough are we having a conversation with the investment committee. And our hope there was to displace some of the Wall Street-based investment and get it back down to the Main Street level and show that this could actually be a viable return for them. As that grows and as that example starts to gain some traction, I think there's a place for a federal private relationship to participate in there. But understand, we have to work within the confines of our authorizing statutes. So we may have to look towards innovation and stimulating that innovation outside the agency to get to where we want to go.
I mean, there are a lot of examples of public-private partnerships through the federal government and private initiative. You know, I know in the space program, there's been a lot of initiatives in that regard and others. So agriculture seems like it might have, because of all of these recognition of impacts that are for national security, really, if you stop and think about, you know, the impacts of climate change to our national security are considered extremely deleterious. So if we're working to sequester carbon across the vast landscape of this nation, because there's 915 million acres in agricultural production, and currently the new stated goal as of this week is 30 million acres with cover cropping, which is 3%. of that land. So, I mean, there's a big opportunity there to raise that figure as part of a incentive to invest in soil health long-term. cover cropping being a very powerful tool in that arsenal.
Yeah, and cover cropping is one of the initiatives that we're trying to drive home as a means to keep that soil in place and help move that conversation. And it's been pretty successful. The numbers there, though, I think the 900 million acres is inclusive of a lot of rangeland that's already got a cover crop on it. And it's about developing and enhancing the diversity in that existing forage base while we work with our friends in the cultivated sector or the conventional ag farming sector to do the cover cropping to help improve soil health. But I think we're getting to a critical mass of deployment of that practice to start to really analyze the annual income benefits for our producers. And that's when we're going to start to move that conversation more meaningfully as producers start to realize the economic benefit of soil health in their operation.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of producers that have been using these approaches for a very long time, and they can do comparatives about their income per acre is substantially higher than their neighbors who are not doing that. And also their cost of inputs drop considerably. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, almost old school thinking around how you do agriculture in a way that's more perhaps labor intensive, but the outcomes are also more productive to the producer. And I think there's a gap somewhere in that knowledge base that's changed over time. And some of, you know, rotation has not happened. I live in Colorado. I drive from where I live to another town, and I pass a lot of cropland that's all in soy or corn production. And there are fields that I see that never change from corn. Every year it's corn, it's corn. And I'm like, that is not a sustainable strategy. It's a very input high level of agriculture, because we don't have great soil here in Colorado in the first place. So it's a lot of water, it's a lot of inputs, and there's no soil restoration going on. And I find that just troubling to me, given how much we know. But obviously, getting practices to change on the ground is yet another huge challenge. And I'm curious, in your experience and what you're seeing, you know, how can these conversations be brought to the farming community in a way that is an invitation as opposed to something that creates reaction and defense?
Part of every conversation we've had, Selene, is when we're out talking to the producers, we have a few of these folks that adopted some of these no-till practices, if you will, or what have you, years ago. And they say, you know, don't forget about us. We have to have a role in this because we don't want to have to turn over our ground and set ourselves back two decades to be able to participate in whatever programs you do develop to try to incentivize and economize this practice.
Good point.
And as we think about those early adopters, we can find a way to, and some of them have taken that and leveraged it into a business practice. You'll find that most of them are products of the existing commodity ag system that's been supported by the Department of Agriculture for a century now. There's not a lot of diversity in those voices. There's getting to be more on the fringes, but those folks that are early adopters and have a message to convey, we need to find a way to help them do that so that it's affordable for others to actually access. And we can do more of these on-farm demonstrations. You know, NRCS has an entire aspect of one of their programs that talks about on-farm, on-site demonstration days. So as we think about the including the early adopters, we got to be thinking about the innovation that's happening on the farm right now. There's a gentleman that's a family friend of ours. Him and another of our family friends in West Central Minnesota are doing double cropping on the same land, two crops that year, about 60% production of each of the crops. He's got wheat, winter wheat, and soybeans growing in the same field. And he's made a small modification to his harvester to where he can, and then the spacing on his planting, so he can harvest the winter wheat while the soybean is still growing. Mm-hmm. And then it fluffs out and does its soybean thing. I got a chance to see that from his combine this summer. And the fact that we have an administration that has an administrator at the farmer facing agency of the department that's interested in those things and elevating those conversations with the Regenerative Rising podcast really helps us understand that we're at a great place for starting to turn the dial in that direction.
I think, you know, there's no better advocate to a farmer than another farmer. And there's no question, to your point, that there are early adopters who have a tremendous sphere of influence. And I know a lot of, or some of the organizations I'm affiliated with, Mad Agriculture being one, you know, they have a lot of important relationships with farmers. And there is definitely a sensitivity to this opportunity to bring conversation amongst fellows who are interested in helping offer new pathways that they can say from their own experience are changing the success, the value proposition, the return on their farms. And it's just a plus, plus, plus.
You mentioned Mad Ag, and I'm a big fan of what they're doing. Phil and the team, they're just really stretching the imagination of producers into what could be. And it's all on the foundation of changing the way we finance it. And if I hadn't been a part of the team that developed our idea, I would have surely stole theirs and ran with that when we created a CDFI, because I like that approach. It's really more of a cooperative based, relational based aspect than it is this strict balance sheet analysis.
Well, you know, part of the regenerative frame is relational, moving away from transaction. I mean, to me, it's also an indigenous worldview, really. And I'm an advocate of, we have to really change our underlying notions around what it means to be in partnership and in collaboration with others, what it means to create mutuality and reciprocal benefits, so that we're creating these more related, healthy, caring ways of doing business together. Because caring is huge. If you care about the other person, if you care about the land, if you care about the animals, caring changes the lens through which you see. And then you have a whole new set of possible outcomes, because you're literally seeing differently.
You know, we started off early in this visit talking about that diversity in the age group in grazing livestock and how that could bring a benefit. But we forget to, too often, we forget to impose that on everything else in our lives. More diverse perspectives are valuable, and we don't need to be so defensive of our position. If we go into this with the notion of empathy on our mind and trying to understand their reality, and we might find more allies there if we realize, hey, we're actually in this together, but external forces have pit us against each other. And I do appreciate that you recognize it's an indigenous worldview. Our folks on these continents didn't feel as though we were exercising dominion over the resources. We understand that we had a role to play, and there was symbiosis there in that. One of my favorite books to recommend for folks if they haven't read it is Indian Givers, because it talks not just about the ag production aspect of that, but the societal benefits that have been taken from those societies that were here and occasionally bastardized beyond recognition into this conflated sense of personal freedom that we have now, where your personal freedom in some cases may have you thinking that's more important than my well-being.
Exactly.
And the whole conversation around whether we should take the steps to manage the global pandemic together. And that, so that's decidedly not an indigenous worldview. And I think recognition that the regenerative ag practices that are gaining more momentum have their origins in that. It's critical for us to give due recognition to that, because those indigenous communities on these two continents and in other places in the world are some of the most left behind by the way we're doing things.
And they're still some of the ones living with the most deep respect of the sacred on the lands that they're stewarding. And we have a lot to remember around that opportunity to be stewards. We're all short-term visitors here, and that we don't think about multi-generations forward, and that we make decisions based on the well-being of many generations out is unfortunately, I think, part of why we're in the deplorable mess we're in, because we've been so short-term oriented. We've been very selfish. We haven't cared about all of the other impacts. And that is not living in right relationship, whether you're indigenous or not. If you just even take it from the standpoint of this is this extraordinary creation, however it arrived, evolutionarily or otherwise, it's exceptionally amazing. We are this alive planet, and we are not treating it as the sacred relationship that it should be to us.
I couldn't agree more. The only thing I would offer is that I push back on the definition of it as sacred, because sometimes that puts it on too high of a pedestal, and it's basically about feeding ourselves, caring for our neighbors, and it doesn't need to be. We need to normalize the idea of caring for the soil. And if we describe it as sacred, we sometimes get possessive of the things that are sacred to us.
And that's a good point.
It can inhibit the willingness to share those things that are working.
I appreciate that observation. My main aim is to just advocate that we care, and that we see that life is a gift and it's extraordinary. And if we were stewarding it with respect, we could have outcomes that are far more beneficial to a larger group of beings, the plant world, the animal world, the human world. I mean, we're all part of one fabric, but we don't tend to remember that we're part of one fabric of life and everything is interwoven. And that to me is where the indigenous understanding is very superior in that recognition of the interconnectedness.
And that sense of interconnectedness, I think, can really help us zero in on the fact that we all need to get together on doing things in a more climate smart, climate friendly way. You know, you mentioned Colorado earlier, and the suburban and rural Denver area was just victim to a firestorm that,
yes,
you know, was,
I could see it from my window.
100-mile-an-hour wind, and I'm 52 now, and I don't remember hearing of a 100-mile-an-hour straight line wind until the last 3 years. And in the last year, we've had three different incidences where we had these 100-mile-an-hour straight line winds with no really accompanying storm. It's just the environment's getting more violent. And we're going to have exactly. to understand that we've got a role in mitigating that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you go into climate science and look at what this planet was like kind of before we were on the scene, it was chaotic. And this type of weather patterning is really a reversal of what has enabled us to develop the extraordinary societies around the planet that we have all over the tens of thousands of years we've been here, because the climate had a certain predictable pattern, and it rained, it snowed. There could be extreme events, but what we're seeing today is just the tip of that scary iceberg, I'm afraid. And we better take the signals, because I don't think it'll be easy at all. It's not easy now, but it's going to be even harder to mitigate the problem when we get to this, like the more extreme and unpredictable patterns of weather are in different climates. You know, how do you reliably plant a crop and have it survive extreme rain or changing temperatures that are erratic? We could run out of the runway for having the sustained patterns we've had over time to be able to put crops in the ground, to do soil restoration. We could hit a point where we've just missed the mark so entirely, and it's just out of control.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, as you mentioned that this was a reversal, I think more than that, this is maybe an outcome of what we've been doing.
It is an outcome.
Yeah.
The reversal I meant to just point to an earlier epoch in the cycle of this planet. Weather was radical and intense, but that was before plants and us were here. And, you know, the evolution of life on the planet has brought forward this calming of and a creation of, you know, regularity, if you will. You know, summer is summer, spring is spring, and winter is winter. I just recently heard about an article that was saying in the 2100, summer could last 6 months. And that's scary. I mean, in where I live, if summer lasted 6 months, we would be parched beyond recognition. And that's about, you know, nobody's going to fare well, the plant life, the animal life, the human life. And then in other parts of the world, they're probably going to see extreme rainfall. And so again, you know, this, we don't want that. That is not a desirable path to be on.
Yeah. And I took your use of reversal out of context there. I was thinking of the shorter time frame. You were talking before anything was living here.
Yeah, I was just, yeah. Yes, it's just in the sense of how much carbon is in the atmosphere. There was a time in the records of Earth where carbon was out of the balance that we've enjoyed, that's enabled life to thrive. And we're now putting it back into that level where life won't thrive, and it's caused by human activity. And we just have to, you know, stop being in resistance to that and instead be in service to creating shared well-being. I don't know how to make these things more like not political, but just about how do we create well-being for ourselves, our children, our children's children, our grandchildren, our great-great-great-grandchildren? I mean, I don't know how to make that appealing, but I just don't understand why it isn't. I mean, it confuses me.
And that's the real confounding question, is how do we make that matter? So that's the job we have ahead of us.
It is the job we have ahead of us. And I'm just deeply grateful to you being in the role that you are. I think I forgot to mention that you've made history as a Native American sitting in this role as administrator at the Farm Service Agency. Congratulations and yay. What a beautiful part of what this administration has been doing to like make sure appointments are more representing the true composition of our society. It's just like so long overdue.
And as I have occasion to look at the numerous Zoom and Teams meetings that we're on, the more of our political appointees that get seated, the more diverse those screens become. And to your point, the administration has done a fantastic job of elevating those voices. Another important part of my history, along with being the first Native American administrator of the Farm Service Agency, is I would wager that I'm probably the first one that had their formative years during the farm financial crisis of the 80s. So ag finance is always going to be at the very forefront of the conversations that I may engage in across the agency, across the department, and with our stakeholders.
And it couldn't be a more like perfect background for this moment, because really, as annoying as it is, money really is the driver. And if money is being distributed more equitably and in a way that actually creates long-term success as its aim, then the ability for producers to start to embrace these innovative approaches to cropping systems, being able to keep more animals and not give up the entire herd, but to be able to cultivate more living system, holistic approaches to agriculture. I mean, the plus side is so huge.
I agree. And I think too often, as we're having conversations at the national level, we paint with too broad of a brush. And the president said some things that really resonated with my beliefs about capitalism the other day. You know, capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. And I've been saying something similar. I have no problem with capitalism. We were all capitalist societies, even as indigenous communities. We understood that as our populations grew, our resources had to grow with us. And to me, that's what capitalism is. But when you start to talk about it solely in terms of the accumulation of one aspect of that, and that's the money, then it tips over into greed. And that's not benefiting anybody on a grand scale. It's helping a couple of fellas orbit the earth, but it's really not doing anything. You know, those two space programs could build houses for all of the folks that need them in this country. And I don't think that is capitalism. I think that's greed. And I don't think greed is good. I think there's a reason that it's lionized in every religious sect that you run into. And I feel
all
like
wise teachings call it out as something that is to be deeply worked towards not falling prey to. That and vanity. Greed and vanity are the two kind of weakest links, and they kind of go hand in hand, unfortunately, because, you know, egotistic notions of personal value above and beyond other, rather than a more egalitarian representation of like all life is equally precious. There is no one person who is more valuable and meaningful than another. We don't subscribe to that generally, but in truth, it's real.
Yeah. And I think very clearly I'm pro-capitalism, but capitalism equals growth and sustainable growth based on the needs of a population overall. And the concepts that we're talking about in reimagining how we do ag finance are most certainly capitalism.
Absolutely. That is intelligent capitalism. And it's, I also have always loved when I first heard the idea of patient capital, I just got all excited. I mean, that felt like a really important reframe so that you could have a longer term intent, because so much of how, you know, with quarterly reports, we've just, one of the big criticisms of the system as it is today is short-term thinking. And we need to have a broader time frame in order to give things a chance to really mature and then be of benefit. And without that, I don't think any of the things we've been talking about today are that achievable.
There's a company called Replant Capital that you're probably familiar with.
I am.
And Robin O'Brien there really has some good quotes around, you're not going to be able to change agriculture with the same tools, financially speaking. And she says it much more in a much more articulate way, but really what it comes down to is that concept that we talked about with the correlation or the similarity between the way we do agriculture and the way we do finance. If you just keep running more input at it, you're eventually going to get there, and you're not. Sometimes you got to step back and reevaluate and maybe try doing things different. And I think this administration and the secretary for sure are definitely encouraging us to think about things differently. And how do we have to change the way we're doing things in order to get the outcomes that we want? And in some cases it's yes. In some cases we can make adjustments.
It's just like in your personal life. If you keep having an outcome because you're patterning your behavior in a particular way and you recognize you don't like that you keep having that argument with your partner, if you don't interrupt or disrupt yourself and look at, well, what is it that I'm doing that continues to get the same outcome over and over again? If you can see the pattern in yourself and disrupt it, the likelihood that you won't have that same argument is far higher. So it's no different in how we conduct our affairs as a society. If we keep following the same patterns and we don't question them, and then we wonder at the outcomes remaining the same, then we're not really using our gift of discernment to step back for a moment. And as you say, like, if we want this outcome, is there another pathway that we just haven't been considering? We've trod this way a long time. It's a well-worn path and its outcome is well known to us. But if we can see over here, there's this different outcome that we're all in a great agreement that we would like to see. Well, there's going to be a path that takes you there. It just obviously requires a different set of ideas. And that's the beauty of humanity. We are innovative, creative creatures, and that's to our benefit. So we have what we need. We just have to cultivate the will to act.
And I think it all ties down to empathy. You know, in our horsemanship program that we've developed here on the ranch, we call it lifemanship. But it's founded on three principal tenets. First is awareness of yourself and awareness of your horse. But you can expand that into human interaction, and that's why we call it lifemanship. Once you have established a sense of awareness, you have to understand where the other party's coming from, and that's empathy. Going into this, you had a desired outcome. So with your awareness of the situation, the circumstance, the other being, an understanding of where they're coming from, and a vision of where you want it to go, you adjust your presentation to effectuate that reality. And that's really what it all comes back down to, is there's a feedback loop that gets broken when you have greed or ego or something like that get in the way, to where you don't have the flexibility to make those adjustments in what you're doing. And it ties back to that producer we started off talking about, who would, if he had the resources or she had the resources, absolutely convert to regenerative agriculture practices, because it's better for the soil health, which is better for their longevity and their ability to continue doing what they're doing.
Absolutely. Well, it seems to me like there is a really, really rich moment to step into. And you are so perfectly situated to help make those changes and bring that influence and really help guide the conversation. So I just have to say kudos. I'm so grateful for our time together. I'm so grateful for your effort and just you being you in this moment. It's just, it's pretty exquisite. I have to think there's some higher intelligences at work right now that have brought us together for you being in this role at the USDA to help change the conversation around how resources being allocated.
And I have to tell you, Selene. My brother is sitting here listening in the background and probably snickering under his breath that you think that there's some higher intelligence that's guided me here. But it feels like we're coming to a natural wind up to our deal. But I want to make sure that I touch on a couple things before we go. That the level of dedication of our Farm Service Agency staff, I think, is far too often understated. Mm. And the administration has a rightful devotion to ensuring more equitable treatment of all people. And in doing that, from time to time, we have to call out the folks that are in the way. But that is such a minority of the staff that we've got. And just want to remind our folks that are going to listen to this, many of our FSA staff have been doing this from their kitchen table or from their home office like you are there while homeschooling their kids through this pandemic. Mm. And the level of dedication at our headquarters staff level is something that every producer would be proud of if they only knew. So I want to make sure that that gets out as well as we talk about the work we're doing and the initiatives that I have the honor and responsibility to lead. There's a hell of a team that's surrounding me, and we need to make sure that we get the praise to all of them as well. So when your producers, your regenerative producers, go into that local office, visit with that county FSA staff, make sure they start off with
thank you.
Great. We understand, and let us know what we can do to help.
I love that you said that. My husband had a role in the federal, he wasn't a federal employee, but he worked with a lot of federal employees. And he was so impressed with the quality of dedication of people in the, and that was in the health department. So I hear you. I agree and applaud that these are folks who are really dedicated and they stay through administrations and serve the communities that they serve, regardless of who's in the White House. So I appreciate that you mentioned their deserving credit and acknowledgement and appreciation.
Very good.
They are thusly acknowledged. So you have been listening to Regenerative Rising's podcast, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. My guest today has been Zach Zucino, who is the administrator of the Farm Service Agency inside of the USDA. And I'm your host, Selene Diaris, founder and executive director of Regenerative Rising. And what a wonderful way for me to re-enter in this role with my organization, having been absent for a while, and to have this conversation with you, Zach. I'm so grateful for your time and appreciate the candidness of this conversation. It's a real treat to get to have some time with you.
It's been a lot of fun for me as well, and I look forward to checking in a couple of years to see what kind of progress we've made.
I will definitely do that. We will make that a for sure thing. All right. Well, take good care. Stay healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you.